This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you had a great Labor Day weekend. We know someone did. Diana Nyad on the beach. You might say that the president has ordered the Congress to get into the water or stand on the beach regarding the situation in Syria. It is fitting that our public radio colleague and athlete Diana Nyad, at age 64, by the way, it is fitting that she finished her record-setting swim from Cuba to Florida yesterday. And congrats.
We should never, ever give up.
She was a little stunned, barely able to walk or talk. She made it to the beach after more than 50 hours. It got me to thinking, is that swim harder or easier than the plunge President Obama has taken here on the question of Syria? Will he get congressional support for some military action or told he can't attack? Will he get some resolution with all kinds of restrictions or an actual declaration of war? That would be a shocker. Would Congress give President Obama the same approval President Johnson got 49 years ago?
Congress gave us this authority in August 1964 to do whatever may be necessary. That's pretty far-reaching. That's the sky's the limit.
Lyndon Johnson got a blank check in Vietnam with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, not unlike the open-ended congressional authorization that George W. Bush got in 2003 in Iraq. But getting congressional authorization is different than asking for a declaration of war. It's a constitutional gray area that was recognized even back in 1967 when the war in Vietnam was going badly.
The ball game has changed. It's apparently unwise for anyone in the world to declare war. You just go to war, apparently, but you don't say you're at war in a resolution of that type or a declaration by Congress. And this is why I think we must now examine the procedures that we use and tighten those procedures and adapt them to the changing circumstance.
That's Republican Senator Charles Percy from Obama's state of Illinois back in 1967, a member of the GOP who challenged the U.S. role in Vietnam and the fuzzy congressional authorization for it in language that sounds very relevant today. What is authorization? What is the voice of the people on military action in Syria? What do you think of the ability of Congress to reflect the will of the people on this issue? Anna Marie in Harvard, Illinois, says, I don't know if bombing Syria will help the people there. My heart is heavy thinking of the average family in Syria. Bend, Oregon, Raul writes, for once, the Congress must listen to the voters. Unless the Arab League takes action either on its own or leads the way with the rest of Europe to follow along with America to throw dictators out of the Middle East, the American public does not want to enter another war in the Middle East. All week long, we're looking ahead, gathering consensus in the broadest way possible. How do you think your representatives will vote on this? Let us know. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Let's hear your authorization, your declaration. So what does the apparent target of this chemical weapons attack think of the president's decision to let Congress decide now on any U.S. intervention? Con Ross is a former British diplomat and the founder of Independent Diplomat, a nonprofit diplomatic advisory group that is currently advising the Syrian National Coalition. Con Ross, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you think the opposition's sense of this is? Are they relieved that the president is taking an action? Do they feel that it's a non-decision decision? Are they going to be sitting around watching C-SPAN for the next week and a half?
Well, I mean, this is my personal view of their take. Obviously, they have their own views, but I think it's fair to say they are impatient for action. They have been for a very long time. They have sought weapons supplies for the rebels. They have sought more robust military intervention to change the military balance for some time. And obviously, the administration's words about the imminence of a strike have shifted in tone to something more reserved now that the president is seeking congressional approval. But of course, at the same time, the coalition has absolute respect for the democratic process in the United States.
Do they view this as a more limited action that they would have wanted because Congress is involved?
I don't know that we know that yet. We don't really know the full extent of what the U.S. is planning in terms of military strikes. Personally, I was very interested to see John McCain's remarks. I think it was yesterday after seeing the president, where McCain seemed to indicate that the administration was considering broader military strikes than merely hitting CW sites, chemical weapons sites, in some kind of punitive way. And that would make sense. That has the potential to change the military balance, perhaps, if one might put it this way, to bomb the regime to the negotiating table.
There is certainly an argument that the president may be looking for some sort of political cover here, but there's also an argument that the president has a reputation for wanting military action with real impact. If you look at the Osama bin Laden raid, you really see that maybe the president is holding out here for an operation that will have some serious impact. And so the McCain view that you've just expressed may be actually in the cards.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think it's the logical view. People in the administration aren't stupid. They know perfectly well that they want to bring the Syria conflict to an end. I don't think they want to do something minimal and tokenistic, because that won't be enough. I mean, I think the administration's persistence in trying to end the conflict diplomatically has been pretty clear since John Kerry became Secretary of State. And my hope is that this crisis will actually add to the energy and impetus diplomatically to bring the parties to the table to discuss a transition.
So Congress now will be involved in an actual debate. It appears the Russians will be sending representatives to brief members of Congress on their view of the situation, obviously in contrast to that of the Syrian National Coalition. I suppose the option exists for the coalition to hire lobbyists on K Street and do their bit of lobbying on their own. What's going to happen?
Well, they don't have their own lobbyists on K Street. They just have us, and we're non-profit, and we're not really lobbyists, and we're just advisors. But that case is pretty strong, and the U.S. government has, in a way, kind of made it for them. The Russian case is not strong, doesn't carry any real weight, in my view, having worked on chemical weapons inspections in Iraq and knowing about them more broadly. It's completely implausible that the rebels would have done this. There's no evidence that they have the capability to execute a sustained attack in multiple places of this kind. The only plausible culprit is the regime.
So is the United Nations out of this? Is this U.S. process supplanting the United Nations and the Security Council?
No, in a kind of weird way, they're running in parallel, because at the moment the UN is waiting for the results of the chemical weapons inspections, and it's expected that he will report to the Secretary General, who will then report to the Security Council, I imagine, in a couple of weeks with some kind of view as to what he has observed in Syria in the last few days. But one oddity of the UN process is that it's not expected that he will give a view as to who has used the weapons, merely whether they have been used, which frankly I find pretty odd. However, it will be hard to report on whether they have been used without making some kind of indication in the detail of who may have used them. So what this will mean is that there will be a diplomatic discussion, probably in the UN Security Council, following that report. And of course, the US will be hoping that that report will be pretty clear and will reaffirm their own view of the situation.
But the way you've described it, it's going to be on the sidelines. Things will have happened by then. They're not going to be pointing a finger at where the chemical weapons came from. And the Congress will have already had its vote, probably.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a side debate. I think that's right. The UN Security Council will not make give a mandate for military action. The Russians have made that emphatically clear that they would block any kind of mandate. I think they would do that even in the face of very clear evidence from Syria, though potentially that could change things. I don't see the slightest chance that the Russians will allow any kind of military authorization from the Security Council.
Finally, you're a diplomat. You advise the Syrian National Coalition on diplomacy, yet I can't resist to try to draw you out here. The price of doing nothing. The president seems to think that there is a price to the international community of doing nothing in Syria. I suggested that the price has already been paid by the Syrians. 100,000 lives, 2 million refugees, 1,429 people dead from this chemical attack. Is that too cynical of you?
No, I don't think it's cynical at all. I think Syrians on the ground have been crying out for some kind of international action to end the conflict, and that has not been forthcoming in anything like a sufficient way. And I think they would hope, and I would hope, that this crisis will bring much, much greater political and diplomatic attention to bringing the conflict to a close.
Assad ousted as a result of this intervention? You don't believe that, do you?
Who knows? I mean, military intervention is a very unpredictable thing, and I think anybody would be very unwise to claim that they know the certain consequences of any such thing. What I hope, however, is that he will be forced to consider a democratic transition. On that point, notably, there is international consensus. They have all agreed, including the Russians, on something called the Geneva Communique, which points to a democratic transition. The Assad government has not indicated at all it's ready for such a transition, and perhaps military action might force them to change that view.
Karn Ross, a former British diplomat, founder of Independent Diplomat, a nonprofit diplomatic advisory group that is currently advising the Syrian National Coalition. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The nation of France reportedly stands with President Obama on the question of intervention in Syria, although there is no expectation the French would be a part of a U.S.-led attack. The French have a military presence in the Mediterranean. They did help lead the effort to remove Muammar Gaddafi from power in Libya, however. Having the French on board in this case, though, could be a problem for the long memories in the U.S. Congress, which got testy over French criticism of the U.S. invasion of Iraq back in 2003. Remember Freedom Fries? Joining us now is Dominique Moisy, senior advisor at the French Institute for International Affairs. Dominique, welcome.
Welcome.
First of all, what is the French interest here in Syria, and are they fully on board here?
They are only fully on board as far as the Americans are on board. So the decision of France is suspended on the vote of the Congress.
Why would you say the French political situation is so different, seemingly, from that in Great Britain, where David Cameron was unable to get a vote in his own government to support action in Syria after this attack?
Basically, there are three reasons behind that. The first one is the legacy of Iraq. Because the French did not follow George Bush, they said no to George Bush, they are much freer to act than Great Britain. From that standpoint, Cameron is a victim of Tony Blair, whereas François Hollande is benefiting from the attitude of Jacques Chirac. The second factor is that for France, Syria has historical roots with us. And the third reason, probably the most important one, is that as far as it comes to foreign and security policy, the French system is much closer to the ancien régime monarchy than the British system. The executive can do it alone without a full agreement of the legislative power.
Do the French believe that too much time has passed, that in a sense we're committed now to an act that will be at best symbolic and unlikely to change the battlefield in any significant way?
Well, if you look at public opinion, that would probably be the answer. I mean, the French public opinion is as hostile or as reserved to the idea of an intervention than British public opinion or, for that matter, American public opinion. But if you look at the French president, he speaks like Barack Obama. We have spoken too much and done too little. It is the ethical responsibility of the West and the strategic responsibility of the West to do something. The worst thing would simply be to do nothing. That would be a terrible signal, for example, to the Iranian and their nuclear ambitions.
Explaining how the French are definitely a part of the international consensus to move ahead and respond to Syria's chemical attack. Dominique Moisy, senior advisor at the French Institute for International Affairs. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
This is The Takeaway. In our curious democracy, you've got the commander-in-chief, the executive, and the sovereign. In this American system, the sovereign is the people rule. The executive is something else, the White House and all the Article II of the Constitution agencies. The commander-in-chief is just that, the top of the pyramid in the military chain of command. The U.S. president is this constitutional boss of the military and the executive. But the people are supposed to decide when we go to war through our elected representatives in Congress, officially declaring it. We've clearly evolved far from that system. If the commander-in-chief can order certain military operations short of war, why does the president need Congress to approve an intervention in Syria? And whatever Congress decides in the coming days, will the people have really spoken on the Syria crisis? We turn to Jennifer Weber, professor of history at the University of Kansas, author of Copperheads, The Rise and Fall of Lincoln's Opponents in the North. Professor, welcome back.
Hi, John. Nice to be here.
Let's talk about the perils and just how the question of consulting on national security issues has evolved between the president and Congress since the days of Lincoln. It's really been all over the map.
It really has. What you see is that presidents no longer go to Congress and ask for declarations of war. Since World War II, since the end of World War II, they have gone to Congress and asked for permission of use of force, not a war declaration. In fact, our last formal declaration of war was World War II.
And in this authorization business, does it lead to more problems? I mean, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, of course, was an open-ended authorization for force in Vietnam. 2003 in Iraq, similarly. Did President Lincoln get approval for the use of force in the Civil War?
Well, that is that was a strange situation because it was a civil war. And if he could not really ask for a declaration of war because that would be acknowledging the Confederacy as an independent nation. So there was never an open declaration of war. But of course, Congress funded everything that he asked for and passed any number of laws that allowed the United States to continue fighting that war. But it was an odd situation there with how to handle that semantically and legally.
And there will be questions of funding here as well as Congress begins to debate what will be the intervention, if any, in Syria. Do presidents go to Congress for the authorization for the use of force as a way of projecting greater democratic sort of resolve in national security, or is it for political cover to get them off the hook?
Well, I think that they are legally required to do this now under the War Powers Act, which came about after the Vietnam War, because the Congress realized that it had gone way too far with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in granting the president what was essentially a blank check.
But it doesn't appear that the president had to do this. He overrode his own national security team, who had no idea he was even going to do this. They certainly didn't have any expectation that he had to do this. It's never really been decided whether a president has to, go to Congress to be commander in chief. There's a built-in tension.
Well, you're right. And there really hasn't been a court case on this. At this point, it's custom as much as anything, I would say. But there's an ongoing strain between Congress and the executive branch. And the founders designed the government intentionally that way. And so there's always this to and fro between the executive branch and Congress about who has the power to do what. Now, the Constitution gives Congress the power to declare war. That is in the Constitution. So this authorization of power is somewhat different because it is not a declaration of war. And how this fits into the Constitution or how constitutional it is the subject of some debate among legal scholars.
Jennifer Weber, what do you think of this move, just as a citizen and a historian and an observer of the Obama presidency? Is it opening a can of worms or brilliance?
Going into Syria?
Yes. They're asking Congress to approve it.
Asking Congress. I think it's a very smart idea because, first of all, this is our tradition, at least. If it's not the law, it is certainly our tradition at this point that the president asks for permission to use force. Now, Obama really didn't do that when we went into Libya. So that was a bit of a change. But this is more in line with what we have traditionally done. So that's good. The other thing that I think is perhaps an opportunity is if he is getting cold feet about this idea of taking military action in Syria in light of the public response to this, if Congress says no, that gives him cover for not taking military action.
He's absolutely off the hook. Jennifer Weber is a professor of history at the University of Kansas and author of Copperheads, The Rise and Fall of Lincoln's Opponents in the North. Thanks so much.
Sure. Thank you.
What will Congress decide regarding intervention in Syria? You've got a vote.
Hi, this is Salek Locke from Los Angeles. I am in full support of the intervention in Syria to stop the Assad regime and stop the killing of innocent people.
We're gauging the consensus well beyond Congress. Some voices of veterans now. Hugh Martin served in the Ohio National Guard in Iraq in 2004. He's a Wallace Stegner Fellow at Stanford University, author of the poetry book The Stick Soldiers. Hugh, welcome back.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
What do you think of possible intervention in Syria, the description of what military actions seem to be on the table, and whether Congress should get to debate and decide this? What do you think?
Well, of course, I think it's obviously good to hear the debate and see that. But, I mean, it's hard for me as an individual after being in Iraq and then seeing the last 10 years and just knowing, just knowing the history of America being at war. But it's hard for me to say we should go bomb anybody and that's going to make things better. I mean, and I guess it's depressing and sad to think that the only way to really fix things right now or to make any change over there is by sending bombs over that way. So that's how I feel on the one hand, but on the other hand, just, I guess, coming from my time in Iraq and thinking of specific examples and stories over there and the concrete situations, I think about the example of Halabja that was about up in Kurdistan in the northeast, and Saddam gassed them in the late 80s, and nothing was really done about that. And you could even argue, we were arming him to fight against Iran in the early 80s. And so now we have, I guess, the same situation with the sarin gas and, about 1,000 dead in Syria. And, you know, nobody's doing anything about that. And I guess we're all kind of, the world is just kind of staring at Syria as all this suffering is going on. And if I was there with my family in Syria and this sarin gas is being dropped on me and all these horrible things are happening, I think I'd probably wonder, when is somebody going to step in and do something and help us out, to say the least. So.
What are your conversations like with your veteran colleagues? I'm surprised to hear the level of frustration in your voice and that there isn't a logic that informs what happened in Iraq as a way of illuminating what we ought to be doing in Syria. They seem to be unrelated almost.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's obviously a lot of emotion behind the arguments I'm hearing from my veteran friends and the way I feel. And it's hard after these last 10 years and all of the deaths that we've experienced as a country and all the deaths that Iraq has experienced, Afghanistan has experienced. It's just hard for me to think logically, and I think a lot of people are making emotional arguments that we just shouldn't do anything and we should have no involvement at all. But part of me has a lot of sympathy for what people are going through over there, just being in Iraq and knowing how when you are over here in America and we're sitting in our comfortable position in our apartments or whatever it might be, that we can forget that, really bad things are happening and evil is happening, and sometimes somebody has to do something about it. And again, I don't want to say that bombs are the best answer, but I think something has to be done. But the other side of me says, maybe we shouldn't do anything. We shouldn't get involved at all. But I really don't know. I'm wavering about this, which is sort of a weakness, especially in America, to be unsure. But I really just don't know right now.
Well, it's not a weakness, Hugh. Wavering, thinking about the decision, that's what people all over America are doing. Hugh Martin served in the Ohio National Guard in Iraq in 2004. He's the author of the poetry book, The Stick Soldiers. Thanks, Hugh.
Thank you.
My name's Talal Hamadi. I'm calling from Chelsea, Mass. Please intervene in Syria. It's not a war. It is saving humanity.
Thanks to that listener for calling 877-8-MY-TAKE. We want to know what part of the consensus you have here as the U.S. considers intervention in Syria. Post a comment at thetakeaway.org. What do U.S. veterans think about the debate, possible intervention in Syria, the immorality of the Assad regime, the idea that Congress has a voice here? Another voice of veterans now, Kristen Rouse, a captain in the Army National Guard, a veteran of the war in Afghanistan. Kristen, welcome back.
Hi, John. It's always great being here.
How do you feel about this contemplation of intervention in Syria and the congressional debate that looms?
Well, John, as you know, it's a very hard question, and I think it's a good thing to see everybody really engaging in the conversation, trying to learn more about Syria, to see what all the dimensions are, and it's a civil war, but it also has international implications. There's a lot going on there, and I'm no expert at all, but obviously it's a very serious thing to get involved in military intervention, which is it a military intervention? Is it a war? But when we take steps, even missile strikes as what's being discussed on the table, what happens next? And what is the goal that we're trying to reach there? It's very important for all Americans to be talking about right now.
And there's so many asking precisely those questions. But our listener, Talam Hamadi from Chelsea, Mass., suggested that no, in fact, it's the immorality of the Syrian leadership in this particular case that is a U.S. responsibility, in his view, to save humanity. Do you believe that? Do you believe the immorality of someone far away becomes an American responsibility?
Well, John, that makes me think of a very important moment that sticks with me from my time in Afghanistan. In 2010, I was working with Afghan National Army officers and soldiers, but I got to know some of the officers very well. And these were gentlemen who were some of them were in the military during the time of their civil war in the 90s after the Soviet pullout, and some of them were in militias. And as most of us are aware, Afghanistan descended into civil war after the Soviet pullout, and that's what gave rise to the Taliban.
Freedom fighters. The U.S.
Well,
helped the opposition.
The U.S. was helping the opposition when the Soviets were there, but the U.S. Basically did not help afterward, and so these men that these Afghan men I talked to, they told me of battles where thousands were dead. Men, women, children, soldiers, the level of tragedy there was just breathtaking to hear about and horrible. And what do you say to a person who you know who's sitting right there next to you? I remember my time in the 90s, I was in school and reading about Afghanistan and these people were very far away. But to sit next to those folks that I was working with who are now United States allies, they are allies now, and to say, I'm so sorry, I didn't know how bad it was. And to think, my gosh, couldn't we have done something? Couldn't we have done something to ease the suffering, to lessen it, to make it, so fewer lives are lost, so fewer people have to deal with that tragedy and rebuild. What's happening in Syria is absolutely horrific. Damascus isn't that the Paris of the Middle East? Mm-hmm. These are world treasures, and these are real people.
Do you think we can do anything to help?
It's tough, John.
Would you go? There's no boots on the ground. We're just talking missiles at this point, and that's probably going to be the debate. But would you go?
I personally would like to see a very serious, detail-oriented debate and discussion by our elected representatives that rises above the partisan fray and that really talks about the serious issues and what's at stake for the United States and what we could possibly do non-lethal and lethal.
Well, we may just get that this time around, something we didn't really get in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. Kristen Rouse is a captain in the Army National Guard and a veteran of the war in Afghanistan. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
The consensus in Congress on possible intervention in Syria will be heavily influenced by three people, all former presidential candidates and senators. John Kerry, now Secretary of State, former senator from Massachusetts. President Obama, of course, former senator from Illinois. And the man he defeated in 2008, Senator John McCain of Arizona. Todd Zwillick has been speaking to Senator John McCain. Both he and Senator Lindsey Graham had a face-to-face meeting with President Obama yesterday. You might have seen both of them emerging from the White House, encouraged by what they heard. Todd Zwillick caught up with Senator McCain and asked why.
Because the president stated that he would be, as a policy, increasing the capabilities of the Free Syrian Army by getting them the weapons that they need, and also degrading Bashar Assad's capabilities to deliver chemical weapons, which would then degrade his ability to deliver any kind of weapon. So I think it was it would be extremely important in changing the equation on the ground. And that's what we need to do. Right now, Bashar Assad is winning. We need the Free Syrian Army to win.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the Senate voted 3 months ago to increase arms, as you've advocated. It really hasn't happened. I know you're aware of that. Why now will the president telling you we're going to do it? What's going to change, even though that was passed before?
Well, that's why I've withheld my support to actually see what happens. You're right. Not one single weapon provided by the United States of America to the Free Syrian Army has happened. They gave them a bunch of MREs that were about to expire. So it really has been disgraceful. Meanwhile, arms are flown in daily from Russia and from Iran, giving them a tremendous battlefield advantage.
There are a lot of unnamed, to be fair, unnamed White House officials talking to correspondents, saying that what the White House really wants out of the situation, what they have wanted, is stalemate. A managed stalemate. Assad, of course, is an enemy, but he's a well-known enemy. He's predictable. The Israelis know him. The elements in the rebel alliance, if you can call it that, are unpredictable. Some are al-Qaeda. Do you think that that calculation has changed within the administration, that a stalemate is now something they're moving off of, or is that still the policy?
I don't know, but it's a myth to say we don't know who the Free Syrian Army are. They control a large area, and they're doing the real fighting. Al-Nusra and the jihadists are trying to impose Sharia law in the areas that they're in. We know who they are. We can get the weapons to them. The Saudis have successfully. And then you ask about the moral dimension of this. You have to. Are we willing to sit by and watch what has happened continue to happen? 1 million children are refugees, 100,000 killed, the conflict spreading to Lebanon, to Iraq, to Jordan being totally destabilized. But most of all, do we want to sit by and watch this terrible massacres taking place without at least aiding the opposition? And by the way, no one wants American boots on the ground. But to be satisfied with the continuous bloodletting that's going on, I think flies in everything we believe in and stand for.
The White House has sent a war resolution that was basically a blank slate, overly broad, and of course that was intentional, mm-hmm. give lawmakers a chance mm-hmm. to put their stamp on it, color inside the lines, et cetera. What is that going to look like by the time it's voted on? Obviously, the president has told mm-hmm. you that they're going to support something more than just a punishment. Yep. They're going to arm the rebels. Yep. What else will that resolution look like?
Well, I hope it does not constrain the president of the United States. We cannot have 535 commanders-in-chief. There's only one. And if that resolution is too constraining, and I don't believe that it can be effective in anything but pinprick cruise missile strikes, then I can't vote for it.
Your own party has a rising strain of, you've called them isolationist, you can call them non-interventionist.
Yep. It,
in particular, the House vote is going to be an interesting picture of the changing face of the Republican Party on these types of issues.
Oh, I agree, and I hope to convince my colleagues on this issue and then on immigration reform. But you're right; they're not. If you non-interventionist is a appropriate word, but that means that we abandon America's role in the world. Americans are war weary. Americans are skeptical because they have not heard anything from the president as to what our strategy and plan is. I think that the president of the United States should go to the Oval Office and talk to the American people directly and tell them what's at stake here and why he wants to have a congressional resolution. Which, by the way, if he was going to do that, he should have done it a long time ago rather than wait until after he had declared that we would strike. Now our credibility is at stake.
The evidence for the use of chemical weapons in Syria, by what factor is it better than the evidence from Iraq from 2003? I mean, you've seen all the intelligence,
yeah, sure.
You've had the briefings.
Yeah.
Is it better evidence?
Oh, it's compelling and overwhelming. Just look at the bodies stacked up with no visible wounds. There is no doubt about it. And it is vastly different from Iraq, where the Secretary of State told the United Nations Security Council that there was indications of its use and that it was there. It's a vastly different set of evidence.
Senator McCain.
But I understand the skepticism that Americans have. That's why the American people need to be talked to directly.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
GOP Senator John McCain of Arizona speaking to Todd Zwillick. We'll be looking forward to events in Congress today, including hearings in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on the president's request for congressional authorization for intervention in Syria. We'll be looking at that with Todd Zwillick, who also spoke with New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez, the chairman of that committee. Menendez and Zwillick coming up. And some thoughts from you as well. Stuart Warren says, anytime we have inserted ourselves into another country's civil war, we have made things worse for the U.S. and the combatants. As someone who lost family in the Holocaust, I am sensitive to what happens when good people do nothing when faced with evil. While I agree that we should do something, I cannot support direct U.S. participation beyond arming the rebels, many of whom have extremist Islamist credentials, which in itself, says Stuart, is a slippery slope. Stuart hears us on Oregon Public Broadcasting, OPB, in Portland. Christy McCarty asks at thetakeaway.org, is there evidence showing who used the chemical weapons? Diplomatic talks involving all parties at the table seems to be what has worked best to resolve conflicts of this sort. Let's use the International Criminal Court to punish the perpetrators. But first, let's sit at the table to hammer out a peace process with compromise on all sides. Hammering out compromise, passionate views on whether the U.S. should intervene. What should the American role in the world be? Do you agree with Senator John McCain? More on Congress? Stay with us. This is The Takeaway. As Congress contemplates whether to intervene in Syria, it appears the main event won't be between the GOP and the Democrats. It will be between Democrats, members of that party. Will they be on board with an intervention in Syria? Will they agree with President Obama? Tom Cole, Republican congressman for Oklahoma's 4th District, said it best yesterday.
I think it depends first and foremost about how the president does in his own party. I mean, usually the core of the president's support, regardless of the party of the president, is his own people. So you're going to have a very substantial Democratic vote to get there.
Are the Democrats of one mind on intervention in Syria? Joining us now is Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So is there a range of views within the Democratic Party? And we should note there are some very important hearings today where the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is going to hear from the administration, Chuck Hagel, and the senator, former Senator John Kerry, now Secretary of State. So it will be a very interesting debate to see where Democrats stand here. One mind?
It absolutely not one mind. It's the case with Democrats and the case of Republicans. You just heard Senator McCain talking about the what he always refers to as the rising non-interventionist or even isolationist strain in his own party, saying that the House vote will say a lot about where Republicans are with conservatives, insurgent conservatives, and Tea Party members in the House about whether they favor intervention in times like this. Of course, John McCain's a hawk. Robert Menendez is a hawk. And there are, of course, on the Democratic side, as Tom Cole just suggested, a lot of different minds. You have the traditional anti-war Democrats, progressives, liberals. They don't vote for wars. They didn't vote for Iraq. They won't vote for this. You have pro-Israel hawks, of course. John Kerry usually would count himself as among them. Bob Menendez, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, among them. Also liberal interventionists, the types of people who said, John, we should use American might in cases where there are humanitarian concerns. Kosovo was the right thing to do by Bill Clinton. We should have intervened in Rwanda when there was a genocide. That's where we should be using our military might. And the use of chemical weapons in Syria is also the place. So Democrats across the lines there, and you're going to see strains of that all over the map today in these hearings.
Let's talk about Menendez first. Is he the point man for the administration in the Senate as head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee? What have you found out?
Well, he is certainly one of them. I spoke to him this morning. He's going to be chairing that hearing today in the Foreign Relations Committee, part of the public and lawmaker education effort the president says he wants. Bob Menendez is a hawk. He has been looking for increased U.S. intervention in Syria. He's passed amendments trying to arm the Syrian rebels. And I asked him what he would be looking for, in a strike against Syria. Listen.
Our committee voted months ago, 15-3, in a bipartisan vote, to arm the Syrian vetted rebels in order to give them the ability to fight for their own freedom.
And it hasn't really happened.
And that really hasn't happened in a way that I think is necessary. So, but as it relates to the present set of circumstances, my view is that this is about punishing Assad. This is about deterring and degrading significantly his ability to deliver further chemical weapons against innocent civilians. However, in doing so, you actually significantly degrade the regime's overall ability to fight. And so I think that that is a byproduct here. But from my perspective, in terms of the use of the authorization of force, what we are looking at is punishing Assad for violation of international law, for killing innocent civilians, and sending a global message that the use of chemical weapons in contravention of international law cannot stand. And that message is very important not only in Syria, it's important in Iran, where the Ayatollah is watching, are we going to ultimately do what we say as he is contemplating his march towards nuclear weapons. It's also important in North Korea, as the dictator of North Korea says, how far can I get away with the type of actions that I've taken? He has a large chemical weapon cache. Do we send him a message? Do not even consider that. Those are just some of the examples of why this is so important to our national security.
John, I also asked Senator Menendez what he wants from these hearings in terms of building consensus in the Congress, getting that vote, the 218 votes that they need in the House and the 60 in the Senate, and also getting consensus abroad. What does Israel think about a potential strike against a known enemy like Assad?
It seems to me that a consequence of what we do is hopefully to get Assad's patrons, like Russia, to contemplate that the circumstances have changed dramatically inside of Syria and to seek the political negotiation that we have sought from day one and that the Russians ostensibly were in support of. So if a byproduct of punishing Assad for the use of chemical weapons and killing innocent civilians is to degrade his overall ability and gives the Russians cause to believe that maybe we should ultimately end up in a negotiation, then that is a positive result that we would like to see.
My last question for you, what are your discussions with Israeli officials like right now? What do they want to see out of this situation? Assad is an enemy, but he's a known enemy. He's predictable. They know him well. A lot of things could happen that could lead to an unpredictable situation there. What are they saying to you about what they want out of this debate and a potential U.S. strike?
I think Israel would recognize that as we are dealing with Assad, that if chemical weapons can be used with impunity, then Hamas, Hezbollah might say, let's get access to it because the consequences are non-existent. Or if, in fact, you send a message to the Ayatollah in Iran that, the United States bluffs, but at the end of the day I can march successfully towards nuclear weapons, that is not in, I would believe, the security interests of Israel.
Bob Menendez there, senator from New Jersey. Of course, the Israelis have not spoken specifically. We got the French on board in this international consensus and the Australians. Who's against this on the House side among Democrats, Todd?
Well, among Democrats, you have the strong and traditional anti-war progressives. I spoke with Charlie Rangel, John. You remember him, 22-term member of the House of Representatives. He represents Harlem in New York City and a decorated Korean War veteran, says there are almost no circumstances in the current case where he would advocate going to war in Syria. Listen to Rangel.
When you say we are going to war, who the hell are we? I think that when this great nation is being attacked or looks as though we're being threatened, all Americans should be prepared to pay some type of sacrifice. It's truly unfair. I don't think there's enough evidence to declare war, and I never heard of what a limited war is anyway.
So, Todd, it seems like some sort of principled debate among Democrats whether to intervene. With Republicans, will it come down to whether they're in a position to embarrass the president, to really say no to him, that will determine how Republicans vote? They seem to be sympathetic to the idea of using American military power here.
There may be some Republicans, of course, who just don't want to vote for something that President Obama is for. But, John, beyond who the president is, there is a growing tide in Republican ranks among conservatives. McCain calls them isolationists. They don't think the United States should use its military to intervene overseas in these places. They're going to vote on that basis. McCain, the hawk, wants to tamp them down, even within his own party.
two main events in the Republicans and the Democrats Party. Very, very interesting. We'll be watching all day. Todd Zwillick, you'll be tweeting all day, right?
I will, from the hearings.
We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8MYTAKE. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Weigh in on this debate. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.